You're listening to the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Welcome to the CEO Series. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University. Each week, the CEO Series takes you inside the minds and lives of some of Canada and indeed the world's top leaders to discuss strategy, leadership, and today's pressing business issues. And some of the world's top leaders have spent time with us. Justin Trudeau, Muhammad Yunus, Nobel Peace Prize winner, and Sir Richard Branson. This show gives you a thin, well, perhaps not so thin slice, the kind of thoughtful leaders leading some of today's most successful organizations. Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Susan Cain, New York Times bestselling author of the book Quiet, and now her new book, Bittersweet, How Sorrow and Longing Makes Us Whole. Susan, we'll talk about your new book, Bittersweet, How Sorrow and Longing Makes Us Whole, in a couple minutes, but your best-selling book, Quiet, which talks about the power of introverts and how important they are to society. How many copies did you sell?
You know, I don't pay, and I don't know the exact numbers. I don't really pay close attention. I think it's been about 4 million around the world, but I, you know, don't quote me on that, but something like that.
I guess it's a surprise, but it was really your first book. So like you had no idea you're going to have a New York Times bestseller and all that. So, you know, you've got used to it now, clearly. What have you learned? Are you a bit more extroverted? Like the idea of ambiverts is someone acts like an introvert and extrovert. You're an introvert, probably the most famous in the world in some ways. Maybe Obama is better known as an introvert. But have you changed a bit since you've written the book?
No, I really haven't. I mean, I have gained new skills that I didn't have before I wrote the book. I'm much more comfortable now with public speaking. I'm much more comfortable with being in the media limelight. Whereas the whole time that I was writing the book, I was like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do when the book actually comes out and I have to do all these things? You know, now I do all those things and I don't really bat an eyelash, whatever the expression is. But no, I haven't changed at all in terms of my preference of how I like to spend my time. You know, when I don't have those kinds of professional obligations, you can find me writing quietly on my laptop or hanging out with my family or, you know, taking a walk. Like that's still what I really love to do, those kinds of things.
But you've got one of the best, most watched TED Talks. You talk to thousands of people, but as an introvert, what allows you to talk to thousands of people? Is it because of the topic or what allows you to do that in a comfortable way?
Well, I mean, before I answer that question for myself, I think it is worth just saying that there is a subset of introverts who actually like love public speaking and are deeply comfortable with it. I was not one of that subset, but I think it is worth saying. And in fact, I found that many of my fellow speakers on the lecture circuit are introverts because, you know, they're very often people who have like committed very deeply to a particular topic. You know, they go deep, which is something introverts do. And then because they then produce a book about it, they find themselves on the lecture circuit. So that is worth saying. But in terms of what allows me to do that, I mean, I really care about all the things that I write about. Like these are deep, deep labors of love for me. And I want to be able to connect with people around them, around these ideas and these topics. So this is a skill. This is something that I've learned how to do. And when I find myself in a public forum, when I find the butterflies rising up before I go out on stage, what I always say to myself is, you know, if there's one person in this audience whose life will be enhanced, or maybe their child's life will be enhanced, or their colleagues or their organization or whatever it is, you know, then it's worth it. And I want to give it my all for that one person. And hopefully it's not just one person. Hopefully it's the whole audience. But even if it's just one, that's enough to make the whole enterprise worthwhile.
You're listening to the CEO Series, and today we're speaking with Susan Cain, New York Times bestselling author and speaker. One is that you're thinking about other people. It's not about you. It's about them, and you know what you're talking about. So it's not as if we said, hey, Susan, can you talk about something you have no idea about, but just be clever because you're smart and funny. But you really know your subject, so that helps you. You forget about yourself because you're serving, and you really know what you're talking about. Strikes me as two things that help introverts, well, almost anyone, be a better speaker.
Yeah. And what I would add to that is actually is really caring about what you're talking about. The caring is huge. So like I always say to people in a business context, you know, even if you're just giving a presentation about the quarterly sales figures, you know, you have to find a way to really care about the quarterly sales figures to make your presentation effective. Because that comes through. People, you know, we're all just such social beings that we pick up on each other's deep motivations without even knowing how we do it. So you have to be speaking from that place.
As a writer, and I write too, my colleague Henry Mintzberg, he's in his 80s, has written many books. I never phone him in the morning because he's writing. And just leave him alone, let him write stuff that the world reads. As a writer, what's your writing discipline? Is it every day? Is it certain times? Is it a set number of words? What's your discipline as a writer?
I do like to do it first thing in the morning, just like your friend. And I don't know that I would use the word discipline for it. I use the word more, it's like more of a Pavlovian training, which is to say that I have always written under really delicious circumstances. Like before COVID, I would write in a beautiful cafe. Now, after COVID, I stopped doing that. Now I write at home, but there's always involved, you know, a latte and some chocolate. And now that I'm at home, there's always a candle involved. You know, when it was the cafe, there was always a beautiful sunny window. So I associate writing with one of my greatest pleasures of the day. So it's something I actually really want to do. And I never want to take a vacation. Like even when we go on family vacation, I have to have my 2 or 3 hours going through that process that I just described, because if I don't, I feel cheated of it. So that's my quote discipline.
Do you kind of figure I want to do 2 pages a day or 1,000 words? Like, do you have kind of a sense of at least your average performance?
That doesn't work for me. I like the idea of that. It doesn't work for me because I will often spend a whole work day or work week or work month just thinking about what I want to be saying or researching or restructuring or whatever it is. So I don't know how people do that thing of like, you know, X number of words per day, because there's so, to me, there's so much more that's involved besides the production of words. So no, I just go with whatever I feel like I need to work on at that moment.
Maybe coming from your years as a New York lawyer, but you just Google things, or how do you do your research?
Oh gosh, I do everything. I mean, I do a lot of Googling, as everybody does, but I also travel around a lot and talk to lots of different people. I actually, for every book that I've done, have had a folder on my computer that's called experiential. By which I mean like things that I do where I am immersing myself in a particular experience that's relevant to the book. So like in my most recent book, for example, Bittersweet, I mean, there's so many different experiences that I did. Like I went to a Sufi retreat in California. I went to a conference for bereavement counselors. I went back to my alma mater to talk to Princeton 30 years later to talk to the students about what they were really experiencing there. I went to a conference for people who are working on trying to live forever to figure out what was truly motivating them. So those are the kinds of things that are very much a part of my research, as well as just the kind of classical, you know, reading and Googling and phone interviews and that kind of thing.
Today, we're speaking with Susan Cain, New York Times bestselling author and speaker. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CO Series. So the new book is Bittersweet, How Sorrow and Longing Make Us Whole. What's the central message or a couple key messages that you're communicating in the book?
Well, the book is really the product of a 5 or 7 year quest to figure out the power of a bittersweet and melancholic outlook on life and why our culture has been so blind to its value recently. Because in fact, what we see from what I call the bittersweet tradition, which you see in all our religions and our literary heritage, our musical traditions. We know that this bittersweet melancholic tradition is associated with creativity and connection and transcendence. All incredible superpowers that we all want to have access to And this is a way of doing it that we've kind of been cut off from because we're told not to go in that direction.
In some ways, is it a little bit connected with the extroverted society, America and so on have become? Was that, is there kind of a slight overlap between the two thoughts?
Maybe. There is something there in the way that, yeah, that with the extroverted society, like prizing so much, you know, and just sort of the can do, go forward, be talking all the time. Yeah, and there's something with a bittersweetness that is not simpatico with that kind of society. But, you know, what's interesting is, so I created a bittersweet quiz to help people figure out how prone they are to this kind of outlook and to these states of being. And I created the quiz together with the psychologists, David Yaden at Johns Hopkins and Scott Barry Kaufman. And we looked to see whether people who score high on this test, on this bittersweetness test, whether they also score high in introversion. And I expected the answer to be yes, but it wasn't. The answer was no, there was no correlation. But there was an incredibly strong correlation, very high correlation between bittersweetness and high sensitivity, which, as you know, is the trait identified by the psychologist Elaine Aron to describe people who react with greater intensity to everything that life presents you. You know, you react more to a beautiful sunset. You react with greater joy to a beautiful sunset. You react with greater annoyance to a construction site outside your window. So high sensitivity and bittersweetness seem to be the place where there's really that mapping. And of course, in my book, Quiet, I did talk quite a bit about high sensitivity because there's such an overlap there.
Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Susan Cain, New York Times bestselling author, about her new book, Bittersweet, How Sorrow and Longing Makes Us Whole. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CO Series. Next up, we'll dive deeper into the book and some of the stories Susan shares on being bittersweet.
Top-notch insight from proven leaders. This is the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again, you're listening to the CEO Series, and today I'm speaking with Susan Cain, New York Times bestselling author and speaker. I'm almost jealous. I am jealous because it's something where my wife is more bittersweet than I am, but in some ways I'm more apt to rush and not notice the sunset, and it seems like I'm losing something there, that I should try to be a bit more bittersweet in a sense. Like, do you think people can grow into it if they put time and energy into it? Can I get better at it, I guess?
Yeah, absolutely. I think my philosophy of life is that there are any number of superpowers that are available, right? There's like the lightsaber, and there's the wizard's magic, and there's the spidey senses. There's all the different things available. And some people tend to be granted one versus the other. And it's really great to know which superpower you've been granted that comes to you most naturally. But we can always learn skills from other domains also. Absolutely. So, you know, the bittersweet person can benefit, I think, from being in the company of somebody who's sort of like an unfailing optimist, let's say, and can learn a little bit of that view of the world, even if that's not exactly who they are, and vice versa for you.
So something I can grow into.
Yeah. And I would also say people become more bittersweet via their life experiences. You know, like the more you experience life's kind of collection of trials and triumphs, the more bittersweet you inevitably become, because what bittersweetness really is an understanding of the way that joy and sorrow together are fundamentally paired. And a deep understanding of the impermanence of this world. But that with that recognition comes an intense joy in the beauty of it all. And I think that those perceptions come to all of us with time as we experience life.
Part of it, one could argue, it's kind of like growing up to some degree. As we get older, you know, parents die. You know, I was very moved to read about your brother and father is probably more your brother just because that's just too young. Where elderly parents like mine both have passed on years ago, and that's part of life, you know. But it's someone like your brother, and then followed by your dad, like I literally was moved to tears by your writing and what you had gone through. And so it's something where you go, what can you do about it? Nothing. And so you have to deal with it and come to terms with it. And that's part of what your book discusses.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think that this is a question I've been thinking about all my life, like just all these facets of life, you know, just of the way things are set up, you know, the fact that everything is mortal and the fact that the lions never do lay down with the lambs and all these things that we yearn, that we wish to be different. And what do you do with the fact that this is the life that we have, also with all of its attendant joys and beauties? It's trying to make sense of that.
You're listening to the CO Series, and today we're speaking with Susan Cain, New York Times bestselling author and speaker. One of the people you did a talk with was a violinist, Min Kim. Tell us about Min's story and why that really resonated with you.
Yeah, so Min has become a dear friend of mine. Min is a world-class violinist who, when she was about 17 or 18, I think it was able to acquire this incredible Stradivarius violin. And, you know, if you know anything about violins, the Stradivarius are just like the pinnacle, not just of being a violinist, but like of music itself. They're considered like a vehicle to the heavens. And so Min acquired this Stradivarius, which for her, this violin literally became her everything, her best friend, her twin, her lover, her child. She poured all her love into this violin. She literally lived in a tiny little shoebox of an apartment because all the income that she was earning from her music was going into the upkeep and perfection of the violin. So it was truly her everything. And then there came a day when she was right on the eve of her worldwide debut, when the violin was stolen from her. And she plunged into this terrible depression, which she didn't emerge from for years. And she literally just stopped playing music. She stopped doing everything. It was such a crisis, such a catastrophe, really, for her. And then one day she did emerge and she started discovering new creative forms, including writing. And she wrote a book called Gone, all about what that violin had meant to her and what its loss had meant. And that's actually how we met each other. We have the same editor, and her editor sent me this book before it came out. And I stayed up all night reading it. I was like, so captivated by her story. And I just felt the story was everything. It's, you know, the sacred love with which she invested this violin, what it meant to her, the fact that that the loss of it was a kind of death for her, and then the rebirth that she ultimately had. And she says now, you know, if you talk to her about it, she's like, all the cliches about death and rebirth are actually true. That's exactly what she's experienced. And she said it like, she actually said a really amazing thing. I told her that I'd had this fantasy that the reader, well, there's a whole long story involved, but the backstory of what I'm about to say is that her violin has since been found and for complicated legal reasons has now been purchased by a very rich person. And it would cost Min millions of dollars to get the violin back. So I said to Min that I had this fantasy that the readers of the world could unite and raise the money for her to get her violin back. And she said this amazing thing, which is that she shouldn't really have the violin back now, because the violin has gone on and had its own stories and its own experiences, and she's had hers, and she wishes for it to be well, but they no longer belong together. And I was so struck by that, you know, just like the deep understanding in that of the way in which life is this endless series of transitions. It's not only deaths and rebirths. It's just like each moment gives way to the next moment. And some of the ensuing moments are better and some of the ensuing moments are worse, but the fact of each moment giving way to the next is the thing. That's really what life is. And I feel like that's what her story embodies.
It's interesting because we live in a neighborhood. There's a lot of, it's 4-bedroom Victorian homes. So you don't buy them unless you have kids generally.
Uh-huh.
And our kids are now in university. But I say to parents with young kids, you know, as I know as neighbors, and say, around 15, 16, your kids will go out on Friday night and you and your spouse can have date night.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not that long that your kids are in university and self-propelled. And so it's something where motherhood, fatherhood is very intense, but it's not, I mean, you're still mom and you'll be mom for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
But there's a sense that you don't have to worry about them the way you did when they were babies or small kids.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there's a sense of freedom that it's not forever, but there's another stage, and you'd be most likely a grandmother someday, many years from now. And you kind of embrace the joy of that stage.
Yes.
And the other thing, I've noticed some of my friends, they are in their 70s, they mainly look after their spouse, you know, because they've been married 30, 40 years and mm-hmm. they had children together. And it's something where you deeply love the person,
mm-hmm.
but your life revolves around helping someone who's older like yourself.
Yeah.
But they seem joyful in that and content in that. So maybe we just need to accept the ebbs and flows of life.
That's what I think it is. Absolutely. Accepting the ebbs and flows. And it's funny, my husband and I talk about this all the time right now because of this stage that we're in, you know, and our kids are still living at home, but they're much more independent already. And so we find ourselves, like, one of our favorite things to do is we love talking about where we're going to live when the kids go to college, you know, and like one day we're thinking it'll be by the sea and one day it's by the mountains and one day it's in a European city, but it's just like our favorite topic of conversation. But I also think it's our way of saying to each other and to ourselves that, well, this way of life that we're in right now that we love so much, it's going to come to an end, but there are going to be other joys ahead.
Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Susan Cain, New York Times bestselling author, about her new book, Bittersweet, How Sorrow and Longing Makes Us Whole. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CO Series. Next up, we'll talk about Susan's process and her perspective on storytelling and writing.
Exclusive access to some of the most successful leaders out there. This is the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again, you're listening to the CEO Series, and today I'm speaking with Susan Cain, New York Times bestselling author and speaker. You know, it's because as authors, we tell the same story over and over again. They're great stories, but you will probably tell that story about Min Kim hundreds of times over the next few years. Do you ever get tired of telling stories, or is it just that there's a joy to that?
I don't think I get tired of them so much. I think what I struggle with more is I sometimes wonder, like, oh my gosh, you know, maybe the same person is listening to this interview who also listened to me talk about this 3 days ago. And there feels like an inauthenticity in that. That I don't like, but of course the stories are authentic. I only wrote about things that I really care about. But I struggle with that sometimes. How do you do that?
You started the Next Big Idea Club alongside Adam Grant, Dan Pink, and Malcolm Gladwell.
Mm-hmm.
What's it like working with three other great writers?
I don't know. It's just like a wonderful camaraderie. I feel that way with fellow writers in general. You know, there's like, and I honestly, I don't think it's really that different from what I felt when I worked at a corporate law firm, you know, and there was like a sense of being together in a guild with my fellow lawyers who work down the hall. And so now it's just my fellow writers who are like tapping away at their laptops and going and giving talks, and we're all doing the same thing. It's just a kind of compatriotship, I think, that develops with people who are caring about similar types of work, doing similar types of work, and all of that. It's one of the great joys, I think, of any work that one does.
Do they write differently than you do in a sense of the process of writing? Do they take a different approach to it?
Oh, I mean, I wouldn't want to speak to that. I think we are all different in our different ways. Yeah, I wouldn't want to speak for them. But...
And people can just Google the next big idea club and sign up for it then.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it's basically a book club that you can sign up for where we choose our favorite books of each quarter. And it's kind of a book club. So the books arrive in the mail with all kinds of other access to the writers who wrote them, videos, and all kinds of things.
All the proceeds go to children's literacy programs. Mm-hmm. Why was that important to you guys?
Just because, how can you not care about the next generation of children turning into readers and hopefully writers themselves, right?
Yeah. So it's almost an obvious thing, like we're planting the seeds for future writers.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it's like I also have a friend, Rebecca Wallace-Segal, who started this organization called Writopia, where Writopia basically trains the next generation of writers. And they've got kids from all over the place. And they're training them in creative writing and in memoir writing and everything. And like, I just love it. I just feel like, wow, you look at these kids and you dream of where they're going to be 20 years from now and what they'll be, what their output will be.
Today, we're speaking with Susan Cain, New York Times bestselling author and speaker. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. I write and think about leadership a lot. How does melancholy enrich leadership? Do you have any thoughts, anything strike you on that?
The classical vision of leadership, and one that's probably quickly becoming outdated, is, you know, a standard sort of very positional model of leadership, of people seeing the leader as the one who can hire and the one who can fire and the one, the dominant one with all the power. And you would say that the emotion that one might associate with that type of leadership is anger, or at least a willingness to express anger. And I think there's a different type of leadership. There's a woman named Tanya Schwartzmuller, who's a researcher at the Technical University of Munich. And she did interesting studies where she was comparing these positional leaders versus ones that would be considered more relational, where they're leading more by inspiring trust, and where the employees would report more a feeling like they're on the leader's side and together they're in this shared endeavor. And those kinds of leaders are more apt to be able to or willing to express sadness. And there are certain circumstances where that is the right thing to do. She gives the example of, like, you have a situation where there's a product recall, let's say, because the product has harmed people. That's a situation where a leader who's willing to say, you know, this was a terrible thing and express sorrow about it, can be exactly the right thing for an organization. And then you can imagine other situations where if the organization's under threat, let's say, you really want a leader who can express anger at the threatening source. So, you know, this is back to my standard philosophy that I believe there's different types of tendencies and powers that are most useful for different types of situations.
It's also, you want to be an authentic leader. So mm-hmm. that, yeah. You know, when 20 years ago, when, you know, I was at IBM and you were in law, there was kind of a corporate person.
Yes.
And they put on the corporate suit, where today we want you to be you, but not a jerk. So, you know, there's limits to it, you know, but there's a sense of expressing who you are is what we want to do these days. Are there any leaders you particularly admire that strike you as people that are heading it these days, getting where we want to be?
There's somebody who I interviewed for a Bittersweet. I talk about him. His name is Tim Chang. He's actually a venture capitalist, I guess not a leader in the classical sense. But he basically helps people create their startups. And he has done so much kind of deep, thoughtful work about who he is and how who he is actually motivating him. He talks a lot about how we're so focused on identifying what our core strengths are, which is really important, but that we also need to be understanding our core wounds, because our core wounds often shape what we do. And you know, he talks about how a lot of people in Silicon Valley have had the core wound of having been bullied or something when they were younger, and then they're always trying to overcompensate for that, or you know, kind of prove to their childhood bullies that they've gotten the better. And understanding those kinds of motivations can be extremely empowering. And so Tim has done his own work that way, and it's really shaped what kinds of companies he invests in, and helped him to make more mindful, thoughtful investments. And it's all coming from this kind of deep sense of who he is.
So, not to rush you through life, but what's the next book?
Well, I actually have an idea for a book, but I'm not ready to start working on it yet, because my next big projects, well, right now, I'm unveiling a series of courses that are delivered straight to your phone. So you get them every morning. You get like a text from me or a WhatsApp message from me. And it's either a written message or an audio message or like that. So I have one for Bittersweet, and I'm developing some on introversion as well. So I'm doing that. And then I'm also developing a podcast that's going to start in 2023. And another book will be after those two projects.
Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Susan Cain, an old friend, who's a New York Times bestselling author, about her new book, Bittersweet, How Sorrow and Longing Makes Us Whole. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. Next up, how Susan writes, what her process is, and some advice she has for aspiring writers out there.
They made it, and they're telling you how. You're listening to the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again, you're listening to the CEO Series, and today I'm speaking with Susan Cain, New York Times bestselling author and speaker. So when you write a book, you spend some time getting the ideas out there and, you know, circulating your thoughts. So you and I live in the world of ideas. We want to get them out there. And people can disagree, and that's fine, but you want to make the world, through your ideas about introversion and bittersweet, make the world a better place through it. So you don't just finish it and then walk away. You got to spend some time getting the ideas out, and you have a platform to do that to some degree, given the success of your earlier book.
Yeah, and I think people who don't write books don't realize how much time one spends and needs to spend on the part about getting the idea out there, you know, because like I finished Bittersweet, I don't know how long ago, but a while ago, you know, and now I'm spending like all my time out there talking about it and connecting with people about it. And I imagine I'll be doing that for the next year at least.
But in some ways, it sounds like you actually prefer the writing to, I mean, you got to do this to get the ideas out there, and that's half the formula, mm-hmm. but you probably prefer the writing as opposed to getting the ideas out there, though that's important.
Oh, I definitely prefer the writing. Absolutely. I mean, the part when I'm getting the ideas out there, I have these moments that are just amazing. You know, like just some of the people who you meet along the way who I would never get to meet or know otherwise. And I also absolutely like love the moments of connection with readers. And sometimes it's just in the form of a letter. You know, a reader will write me a letter talking about an experience they had after reading the book or what it meant to them. And like those are just incredible moments. But in terms of like the day-to-day life of it, I much prefer the writing.
No, sir, I maybe just being more extroverted, but I enjoy the writing, but I equally enjoy communicating the ideas. I have a book on Generation Z. It's called Hello Boomers, Working More Effectively with Millennials and Zs. So what I'm arguing in one sentence is people over 45 with a degree were taught a modern worldview. People under 35 with a degree were taught a postmodern worldview, comma, therefore they must be managed differently. And I go on for 66,000 words. But, you know, it's something where I like the getting out there and getting the messages. But I'm a teacher. I'm a professor. So it's kind of, you know, it's interesting because you probably did a lot of Zoom things during the pandemic, obviously. And are you back on the road now? And do you enjoy walking in front of a few thousand people? Is there an energy that you don't get from Zoom?
Oh, well, I'm actually, so I'm not really doing public talks right now, just because I'm super careful because of having lost my father and brother to COVID. So, I just haven't been doing that. But yeah, I would say it's a little bit six of one, half dozen of the other. I mean, there is a kind of intimacy to Zoom, a kind of close-upness to Zoom that I really like. But it's also true that, you know, during all those years that I was out on the road, and before COVID, I was out on the road like crazy, you know, all the time. There were just people who I met along the way who have become some of my favorite people on earth, and I would never have known them but for those experiences. So I definitely miss that.
There's an energy of, you know, 5,000 people listening to you, and you know you have good lines because you've used them before, and you know they'll laugh and they'll be engaged. But there's also, you go back and there's the speaker's room and you go, Adam, nice to see you. And you talk to Adam and there's a friendship and a one-on-one. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of, you go from thousands of people to one-on-one, and both bring joy in a different sort of way.
They do bring joy. I will say that for me, for me, the joy is much more the one-on-one. When I'm talking to a room full of people, like, I love it that there's the ability to connect and to convey ideas with so many people at once. I like the fact of that, but in terms of the actual experience of it, I really love one-on-one connections with people. And so even when I'm speaking to an audience of people, I'm trying as best as I can to think of it as one-on-one with each member of the audience, because to me that just always feels like the deepest connection. And I think that actually informs like my style as a speaker also. You know, I'm like not in it for like the drama and the show of it. I'm in it for the deep connection with one person at a time.
Today, we're speaking with Susan Cain, New York Times bestselling author and speaker. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO series. It's interesting, you know, your books sell a lot more than mine, but we don't care how many books are sold at one level or the money, and we'll take it happily, but it's more of getting the ideas out there as opposed to I sold 3,412 books and I'll have 147 more today. Like that's not what motivates. It's the idea that people are listening and thinking about bittersweetness. That's what gets you going, I think.
Well, actually, for me, what really gets me going, the reason I became a writer in the first place is because of this magic that I felt all my life as a reader. You know, you have these magical moments where your brain and heart is just completely connected to the writers. And it may be a writer who's not even alive anymore, and yet you're having this moment of such intense connection. And, you know, you feel it when you're listening to music also. I'm in it for those moments of connection. So that's why I say, like, to me, the best thing in the world is like, if I get a letter from a reader describing that they had such a moment because of words that I took the time to write down on paper, that's to me, the Mount Olympus.
One of the journalist students who works with me asked me to ask you, what's your advice for young aspiring writers?
To spend time writing things down into a diary that no one is ever going to read. And especially, this has always been important for a writer, but it's especially important now when we live in such a performative era and such a judgmental era that it's really hard to write in a totally truthful way. Because of those forces. So first, do the writing as if no one was ever going to read it. Then you can figure out what you want to share with other people. But it's really helpful to get into that mindset, because I think people react most to writers who they feel actually are telling the truth on a deep level. And they're telling the truth about things that don't normally get talked about. And then the other thing I'll say in a much more practical and hack-like way is, given the world that we live in, platform is everything. It's like, it's really hard to get someone to publish your book if you don't have a social media platform and followers and all that stuff. So whether you enjoy that aspect of it or not, it's really important to cultivate that in order to get your ideas out.
So what are you on?
Twitter? Oh, gosh. I'm on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Instagram.
So the central idea of my book is that we're all ambiverts now, saying that if you're a senior executive, so not the average person, but a senior executive in the C-suite, you've got to act like an introvert at times and an extrovert at times to be effective, regardless of your hard wiring. So I got to act like an introvert, but I'm an extrovert. And after acting a bit like an introvert, I need to take an extrovert break and recharge.
Mm-hmm.
Does that idea make sense to you from your many, many, many conversations with people?
Yeah, it does make sense to me. I mean, what I'd add to it is that underneath all of that, you have to take the time to just be who you really are. And I don't think you're talking about not being who you really are. You're more talking about like developing skills and flexing them in order to, and you're saying we all need, nowadays we need the skills in both directions, whereas it used to be there was more unidimensional.
This is the CEO Series. Thank you so much for joining us today. We'd also like to thank our technical producer, Marco Campagna, and our show producer, Youssef Sahoni. Thank you for tuning into the CEO Series. Alla prochaine.